Dystoblikins of the world. I'm Raul Guerrero, and I welcome you to the Dystopian Republic. The late night of November 19th, 2008 is where today's story will begin. After being ravaged by the initial massacres, the former Ferdy Luxor Hambleton sat abandoned like a shame society tried to forget. In a ballroom all but open to the air, Mia, Sonia, and Nova growled their salivations at Janelle Lopez, the girl they've sicked their fun on. The friends happily shivered at each other and their victim, as if they've developed an appetite for bloodshed that'll never know the feeling of a full stomach. Mia squeezed out some blood from Janelle's cut across the left cheek and applied it on her hair like it was shampoo, trying to feel what one of Gregorio Jr.'s four horsemen felt. It made her, Sonia and Nova, joyful one moment, pensive the next, and filled their third with commiseration. On June 6th, 1989, Mauricia and her yellow-crossed lackeys were riding horses through Las Grandes Cascadas' dense nature. They were on the prowl for rebel settlements and non-subjugated communities, dressing like grim reapers with face masks on. Mauricia's thick black hair blended in with the rest of her Stygian attire, setting a ghoulish example that her lackeys emulated to decent yet inferior results. She and they rode their horses to a dirt road that towering trees and thick brush made barely distinguishable, making her and them laugh. Expecting a rebel settlement or non-subjugated community behind the cover, Mauricia found the attempt to remain unseen amateurish, but somewhat amusing. She and her lackeys had repentant detainees cut, saw, and shove aside the trees and brush until the road was unblocked. Mauricia thanked her prisoners, called their work a start to their redemptive journey, and assured them that the payoff will be oh so sweet. Leading her lackeys several miles down the road, the nature she came across struck her as very familiar. Then it stopped her dead by petrifying her with a sight she hadn't seen in 20 years. Mauricia's first day of high school was August 21st, 1961, and for girls like herself, that meant she had another year to assert her popularity. As a granddaughter of Hambleton Sr., being a queen bee wasn't hard, even if her personality lacked the required honor so horribly that it strained her relationships with those closest to her. Mauricia opened her bedroom window, yelled out two good mornings, and told the people of Hambleton to acknowledge their princess's awakening. Only the servants who worked for Hambleton Jr.'s grandiose estate did what she told, and that was driven by a worry of being fired if they didn't. Those beyond Mauricia's home were relieved that her workers complied loud enough so that they didn't have to fill in the noiseless gaps. Hambleton Jr. sipped his little cup of espresso with a grin that begged his fourth child to spare him of any further annoyance. Anselma's cringe turned a subtle green at how fake Mauricia's ingenuous display was, having experienced and endured her real character. Hambleton III wanted to tell his sister to shut up and never speak again, but tuned her out instead, channeling that angst in a book he'd been reading. Inocencio wasn't even awake to hear Mauricia's salutation, then jolted up and off his prone slumber when a thud, scorn, rebuke, smack and brawl smashed onto his ears like a car hitting a brick wall head on. Hambleton Jr. and Anselma's runs to their fourth child's bedroom were swamped by them praying that the fight ends up being less injurious than the last one. They kicked, opened the door to Mauricia's room, seeing her beat Randolph over the head with a hardcover book. Hambleton and Anselma had one heck of a time hurriedly pulling the teens apart, as the fighting was as indefatigable as any one Dave had to break up. Mauricia told her mom and dad to look at what her so-called brother did to her, crying about how he ruined her in a way that she's unlikely to ever recover from. Randolph described the injuries all over him as a labor of love from the bottom of his quote-unquote sister's heart. He held Mauricia at fault for making him look like that four-eyed panty waist he reduced to a bloodied crybaby the other day. Hambleton didn't care who started the fight, nor did he want to hear another whinge or have an endless parade of excuses pass him or Anselma by. He said that since Randolph started the fight and Mauricia fought back, the fair decision would be to ground them both for 3 weeks. In Anselma's mind, her husband was too lenient since the fight wasn't the first of its kind and the second one in a month. But the nauseating dismay it plunged Mauricia and Randolph into made her take that belief back. And since the groundings happened days before the big trip, this meant that for both teens, going was pretty much out of the question. That devastated Mauricia and Randolph such that it got them on their knees begging to still be allowed to go. Their pleas were laughable to Anselma and sickened her with a rage so strong that she was ready to inflict the kinds of scars that even the toughest kids will feel for years afterwards. Hambleton told Mauricia and Randolph that they will not be going to the retreat in case that wasn't already clear. He coldly instructed those two to go to or stay in their rooms, have the workers fix them up, and get dressed as school awaited. Randolph gave Mauricia one last fuming frown, stomped out, and slammed the door, an expression she met with two middle fingers and a wish for him to sleep and never wake up ever, ever again. The ending of the fight was something Emerson, Amy, Chantel, and Rafaela thanked God for, all of whom had locked themselves in their rooms. For the brawl's duration, their emotions swung from begging for the brawl to hurry up and finish to shaking in terror at the anger and hate raging all around and back to said pleas. Tended by her father's workers, Mauricia mentally got lost in a forest where the leaves feathered white, branches sheened gold, and ground skied blue. It was based on a book Anselma wrote and illustrated for her kids, then sold copies for every child to read, A World of Lions and Eagles, as well as Wolves and Snakes. Each second marked the concealment of a cut or bruise on Mauricia's skin, then came the stripping and disposal of her dirtied clothes. After that, she had her out-of-place, frizzed-up hair washed back together with shampoo and conditioner, making it easy to dye said hair the sunny yellow cardinal red mesh most at school respected or feared. She was put into a silky knit top, leathery corduroy pants, and shiny flat heels, having a big flower pinned onto the silk, covering her right breast. Mauricia was proud of how memorable she looked, but didn't thank the workers for their work, telling them to get their fat, ugly, lowly faces out and spare her of any further whiffs of their malodor. The workers who tended to Randolph profusely apologized for their limited success in hiding his longer, deeper cuts and more discoloring bruises. He saw how handsome he looked in his fancy polo shirt, tailored suit pants, and shined loafers, accepting their apologies with a smoothness equaling that of his trim crew cut. Watching the workers hurry out, Mauricia's conceited beam masks moving images of her beating and stabbing them to death with the supposedly indestructible scepter she got for her 13th birthday. She longed to know what murdering another human being felt like, drooling over how spectacular it'd be to feel that power and control. Sitting with Inocencio, Randolph, and Emerson in a limo-like sedan, Mauricia tried her hardest not to glance at either of her brothers. She daydreamed about the chapter she's about to start being as fabulous as the one now in her rearview mirror. At the time, Mauricia and Emerson were freshmen, Randolph was a sophomore, and Inocencio entered the 1961-1962 school year as a senior who no longer had Hambleton III at his side. Meanwhile, another one of Hambleton Jr.'s limos dropped off Amy at Hambleton Junior High, and a third took Chantel and Rafaela to Hambleton Elementary. All three were still shook up by the fight that started their day, but saw school as the cure to that upsetness. At Hambleton High School, Lucy Sadilek and Erica Popescu waited for their queen by chilling like good little head drones. Their outfits were identical to Mauricia's in terms of style and fabric, but differed in color, which hardly made them look any less elite. The starts Lucy and Erica had to their days were tough in their own right, weakening and destabilizing the foundations, holding their hubrises. Last night was the first Sunday in 3 months where they didn't sleep over, then go to school as one the morning after. Inocencio was thankful that the kids who admired Hambleton liked him too. Randolph ran to join his friends in kicking an 8th grade hooky player's butt, and Emerson looked at the cliques that formed, hugged himself, and walked inside with his head held high. Mauricia hand-waved and shrieked a greet. Lucy and Erica reciprocated, hugging with an ebullience that was more syrup than batter. She unintentionally brought the love fest to a halt when she asked how her favorite mutts were doing, forcing out twin laughs that tried to find a humorous light in a realm of resentful darkness. Mauricia's ask referenced Lucy and Erica being Bromelians who were half Czech and half Romanian, respectively. She loved reminding her best friends of that, but they reviled it every time she brought it up because it demeaned them a lot more than it exalted her. Mauricia, Lucy, and Erica went about their day like they always did, turning halls into fashion show runways, smashing into lockers the faces of girls from East Hambleton, ganging up on boys who didn't gush at them, and acting innocent when the bell rang. The girls walked into class blind drunk on an imagination where statues and monuments of them were everywhere. That fantasy land came into an unmerciful collision with a reality that corrected and reversed the mistake Mauricia, Lucy, and Erica benefited from. The correction and reversal left the girl staggering home and too despondent to make the call to request rides. Needing Mauricia and each other more than ever, Lucy and Erica accepted their friend's piteous plea for them to stay near her with all the world's yays. As of this, the pangs tearing the girls apart stung and lingered as much as the lingering stings drawing blood out of their psyches. Mauricia was followed by Lucy and Erica into her estate, discovering that no Rosarios or workers were present. But fortunately for her, she had keys for the gate and front door, granting herself and her friends entry. The ambience in Mauricia's estate was a sanctuary that couldn't have come at a more needed time for her, Lucy, and Erica. It promoted healings that stuck on the girl's leg, bandages containing a salve that numbed the pangs on the surface and layer under it. Every piece of the reality that devastated them was loud, disorderly, and sharp, mocking them with noises only peace and quiet could mute. Their staggers almost gone, Mauricia wanted to confide something in Lucy and Erica, and that it was down in the wine cellar. It was a desire she couldn't fulfill due to two things she was never able to obtain until that night, expecting and being right to assume her parents forgot to lock said things away in a safe they told her not to try opening up or else. Still, even that didn't matter as a key Mauricia shaved up had the shapes to unlock and relock it and access what hid within. Her friends were in awe at the old yet exotic collection before them, even though they've been in the exquisite crypt many times. But where Mauricia took Lucy and Erica to was a bookshelf that Hambleton Jr. appropriated to shelve Hambleton Sr.'s oldest wines. The shelf was two that a deadbolt lock pressed into one, opening like a door to reveal a real one that's subtly cloaked by wall and clear paint. Mauricia had the keys to not only have said shelf, but also the door to a large closet that plastered a warning for all enterers not to consume, dispose of, take, move, or even touch any one of the bottles. Alarm bells went off in Lucy's head over the strong wording, but she shrugged it off as its red flag being too quick to raise itself. Erica knew she had seen the bottles before, and that sufficed in her not liking where Mauricia's confide was going. Lucy was in awe at the narrow-necked works of art she was within arm's reach of, taking in a beauty she thought she'd never behold in person. Mauricia presented to her and Erica a port wine made with grapes so rare that they exist only in Sochitilia, a nation about the size of Kansas. It was between Brumelia's Desierto del Sureste province and Mexico's Baja California state, one that has had its own share of bright highs and dark lows. Mauricia called the wine perfection incarnate and a wonder no one but Hambleton Sr. could sculpt in a bottle, delighting in that description looping in her mind. Lucy shared in her enjoyment, but all Erica could think about was how deep in water all three of them would be if any remnant or opportunist knew where Hambleton Jr. hid his secret. Mauricia grabbed the bottle third from the center on the left side, held it like a kitten, and told it that it was her and her friends' ticket to their brave new world. Lucy thought that she wished to show the wine off to everyone at school in an effort to get their popularity back. Erica had the same thought, but it was bogged down by her worry that new fires will break out from Mauricia's certain success in extinguishing the ones already raging. Mauricia assured her friends that she had it all figured out, proving this by replacing the bottle in her hands with a luckily guessed imitation, calling it nothing more than grape juice, black food coloring, and corn syrup. She said that the added yeast and rancid corn oil drips will disguise its inauthenticity as being the result of spoilage. Lucy and Erica followed Mauricia out of the closet, watched her relock it and the shelf as if they'd never unlocked it that night. Little did either girl know of the power their friend was about to unleash or the bottled additives she'll use to do so. All three weren't aware that from the moment they entered the estate, their words and actions were being watched and heard by a horrified Randolph who struggled to maintain his cover. Mauricio replaced the keys in the safe and moved it to look exactly like how they looked when she caught her parents' careless mistake. Lucy and Erica could feel the love that they knew the whole school would give them for possessing an unparalleled delicacy. Mauricio had them follow her to her bedroom, for she has another confide that'll shoot their popularity up to heights reached few times before. She placed blindfolds over Lucy and Erica's eyes and earplugs into their ears, promising that they'll soon be all smiles. Mauricio nibbled on and tore off the bottle's capsule, pierced into and twisted out its cork, and carefully put it down to ensure that no noise was made. Her eyes turned up to tell her grandpa how unfortunate it was he didn't live to see his dream come true, but knew that from heaven he was thanking her for the tribute that no Rosario had the guts to make. Mauricio took two tiny bottles out of her pockets. One was full of her own blood, and the other contained a maroon potion. The magnitude of what she was doing hit her, freezing her with a hesitation that was staring at its last chance to turn back in the eye. Mauricio inwardly told that warning to burn in hell, as she had little left to lose, pouring her blood and the potion into the wine and watching its dark red color turn even darker. She reached into her dresser's top drawer and grabbed two syringes, staring at them with a lust that imagined the world bowing down to her. Mauricio noticed Lucy and Erica's patience running out, and so she repeated her promise, but it had less weight the second time than it did previously. Time being of the essence, she filled her syringes with her concoction and jabbed both her friends simultaneously. Lucy and Erica shrieked the second they felt the needle hit their backs, then gasped in horror as the tainted wine gushed into them. They fell like rolling rocks coming to a stop on a valley's base and clenched their bodies as hard as they could, screaming above the tops of their lungs as if their very beings were coming under an external force's control. Lucy and Erica felt their needs to please and serve Mauricio increase tenfold, sensing the limits of their loyalty to her recede from feel. Their screaming relaxed into sleeps that were sealed tighter than a locked safe, breathing like conversions in progress. Mauricio gazed at Lucy and Erica as cunningly as an evil scientist watching her creations incubate. Randolph shook in his socks, whiter than fabrics, with no dyes whatsoever, despairing at how doomed he'd be if he told anyone what he saw. And what whitened him as intensely was the price many will pay as a result of his sister prevailing and him being powerless to stop it, intervene, or even prevent it from spreading beyond Lucy and Erica. Mauricio raved that with the power now in her hands, she'll never feel pain or hatred again, and will enjoy making her family, in name only, pay dearly. She chuckled, then laughed, with a malice ill enough to make herself out to be a mental case, petrifying Randolph into running back to his room and pretending to be asleep, praying for his sister to buy his act and not do anything harmful or even deadly to him. The main limo pulled up to the estate and vacuum spat its rear seat doors open, letting Hambleton Jr. step out to Mauricio helping Lucy and Erica outside. He asked her what he told her about having visitors unannounced, irritating her into asking him if he forgot that it was against the law for a parent to purposely leave their children without prior notice. That shut Hambleton Jr. up such that he told Mauricia that he won't punish her for having her girls over or trying to sneak out if she swore not to rat him out to the police. Finding no reason to turn him down, Mauricia accepted and grinned at her father's compromise. That grin hid how she couldn't thank her father enough for ensuring the absolute societal subjugation of the town named after their patriarch. Wounded by helplessness, Randolph crawled to his window and caught Hambleton Jr. and Mauricia uptightly reconciling. He inwardly scorned his father for leaving him and his sister behind just to stick it to them, holding him at fault for the nightmare that's going to unfold. Randolph hoped that his parents took precautions to prevent them, him, and his siblings from coming under the spells of any contaminants that may lurk in the environment. He wanted to believe that the people of Hambleton and beyond had the awareness to take steps in shielding themselves from forces more powerful than them. Randolph feared that his hope and want both had foundations set in wishful thinking, conceding that who on earth would believe a kid like him because, in the eyes of most, he's a spoiled, rich bully and little else, a reputation he only had himself to blame for putting on. For years, there was a part of him that was insightful, which made his parents proud, but got his butt kicked by the very boys he now led. Randolph saw how Mauricia created the tainted wine and concluded that his chances of taking that from her were rather slim, and that there was practically no way he could adulterate it into making it his to use. The best thing he could do was catch his parents using one of their precautions after he and his siblings were expected to be asleep. Having that thought out sufficed in helping Randolph regain his emotional and mental composure. One thing that bothered him, though, was that only he noticed how atrocious Mauricia, Lucy, and Erica looked because he had a decent seat to the reality that went on and on as if it had no conclusion. His sleep still light, Randolph jolted his sit up at a call that turned out to be Johannes Delsed and Cecil Roybal calling him using the former's phone. Glad and relieved he had something to tell them that they'll find hard to believe but should listen to with an open mind, pushing out a smirk and chuckle eager for their leader to unload his insight. The limo drove to the Sadilic and Popescu Castellets, dropping Lucy and Erica off as they were awake enough to step out, unlock front doors, and walk inside. Mauricia knew her tainted wine was working its magic in spite of her friends not responding to her shouting hand-wave goodbye or wish for a good night. She instructed her limo driver to take her to the Hambleton Reservoir so she can have a moment to herself and no one else. When he hesitated, Mauricia called her request in order that she'll tolerate the consequences of and pay him generously for. The limo parked at a campground that looked straight at the reservoir from a neighboring creek. Mauricia had her concoction on her lap, thinking how genius it was of her to pour it into what was a wine-bottled grape juice. The bottle that originally had her tainted wine and the gloves and plastic tub she used to carry out the pour was hidden in a closet-sized safe. Randolph's hide in his room prevented him from seeing his sister make the spilly transfer, and thus all he had against her was the conversion and villainous intent. Mauricia made the 2-mile walk out of the campground and into reservoir grounds, forbidden for non-employees to be in, yet had no officers around to enforce that rule. Sporadic puffs of coastal air crushed themselves upon impacting and failing to break her nerves out of their intact states. Mauricia stared into her new bottle, which had one of the new corks that could be turned back into its neck by hand. She looked around and into every bush, tree, or rock to make sure nobody could watch her, smiling when she only saw squirrels chasing each other, owls hooting, and raccoons munching. Mauricia removed the cork from her bottle's neck and froze when a particularly cold gust told her conscience that she didn't know squat about what she's dealing with. She smiled at the sky, stuck her tongue out, and gave it the middle finger, mouthing that she already told it that the tons she had to gain outweighed what milligrams there were for her to lose. Mauricia held the wine bottle's body, firmly threw it into the reservoir like a javelin, and watched it gush out her concoction before slowly spinning it sink down. Realizing where she was at, she got the heck out of the reservoir ground and back into the campground, slowing to a nonchalant walk that ended when she sat down in her limo and nicely told her chauffeur to step on it with heavy breaths. Asked why she was sweating, Mauricia explained that her sweat was from her late night run, which didn't register as off as she was known for doing that from time to time. Back at the Rosario estate, Randolph heard Hambleton Jr. and Anselma doing some things in the kitchen, his signal to sneak out of his room and to where they were. He watched his parents unscrew the water filter from the faucet, open it, remove a white capsule that's almost completely black, and replace it with a new one. Randolph heard Hambleton Jr. describe what he's doing as the family's defense from evil contaminants. Anselma said that every place where water can come out had one of these filters screwed on or stuck onto. Hambleton explained that the capsules were made of a white potion that's hardened to be like soapy yet slightly spongy stone and will cancel out the effects of all its contaminating counterparts. Finding something he could work with, Randolph stole a couple for himself after his parents walked out of the kitchen. Mauricia's dream that night came in like an angel, but out worse than a demon, reducing her to tears she rubbed dry with a yearn to find out if her tainted wine worked. As her limo pulled up to the school, she saw Lucy and Erica await her step out with the same eagerness they showed yesterday, making her worry that the maroon potion was a fraud. Mauricia was by herself, as Inocencio had a doctor's appointment, Randolph fell ill with a cold, and Emerson was recovering from food poisoning brought upon by the raw oysters he ordered the night before. As it turned out, Johannes and Cecil were also not at school because for them, today was a beautiful day for a game of hooky. When Mauricia approached Lucy and Erica, they hugged and kissed her with the hottest passions she's ever felt radiate from them, bar none. Johannes and Cecil snuck into the reservoir ground, disguising themselves as young park rangers with lunchboxes in hand. Mauricia expected herself, Lucy and Erica, to come under a ridicule that'll rub salt on the wounds the reality inflicted upon them. But instead, most of the students were too sedated to spit out an insult, let alone give a punch, and the few who weren't thought there was no point in trying to galvanize their peers. This pleased Mauricia so, overwhelmed her with feelings she never thought she'd one day experience, loving its every throb and tingle. She knew a sizable minority of the student body would come under her concoction's spell, but wasn't expecting it to exceed her expectations. At that time, Mauricia felt as though her climb to the top of the world couldn't be stopped, but in spite of everything she's done already, her gains grew out of a karma that bought its time in formulating a comeuppance that chose to strike at just the right moment. And during that prowl, over 27 years later, the sight that petrified her to the bone was the memorial of the Maroon Potion. It was a soothingly distressing sanctuary in a forest that hid it from environments capable of disturbing its peace. But to Mauricia, the memorial drew out the events after she learned that her wine did or was doing its job. Had things gone to her liking, it'd be a shrine for her to rely on for happiness, but alas, her future wound up being very different and far less harmonious. One of Mauricia's lackeys harshly asked her if all was all right, snapping her back to being a supercilious marauder. She told her subordinate that a black ice wasp just bit her left arm, as their bites were known for feeling like pure carbon dioxide touching skin. Mauricia's other lackeys secretly had a teehee she couldn't hear, reminding them of how Catalpa convulsed like an infant when a white mold hornet stung her left butt cheek. The laugh's novelty wore off in time for the prowlers to jump off their horses and have the memorial surrounded. Native to Bromelia, the black ice wasp was notorious for biting unprovoked, but the white mold hornet achieved an equal infamy with its often deadly stinger. Mauricia yelled for whoever was in the memorial to get their traitorous anuses out, and that they better use this chance to surrender, as they won't receive another one. Irritated to see nobody come out with their hands up, she gave her lackeys the order to fire warning shots at the former mega poultry house. A subordinate of hers recommended that the memorial be blown to hell, but she declined to do so and thought it was better to raid it, asking him how the hiders could possibly escape her surround. Mauricia then asked him where the scums were going to go if by some miracle they snake through their circle, repeating it four times with increasing volume. She said that the hiders were darned to hell if they resist to the end, and theirs should they submit. Mauricia walked to and stared dead at the front gate-like door, took four giant stomps back, put away her machine gun, and took out a heavy shotgun. She cocked and aimed her new weapon at the memorial's entrance and obliterated it with one explosive trigger pull. Mauricia stomped inside and found herself at the start of a walk that trickled forward, hairpinned around, staggered back, and tightly turned again. She could see portrait after portrait of every soul that succumbed to or been a victim of the Maroon Potion, bringing her pains she hadn't experienced since she was a young adult. However, the one thing Mauricia could look at with gladness was that no one knew she was the cause of a lot that went down in Hambleton during the 1960s. But even with that considered, she still wished that the price she paid to conceal that secret didn't reach a height tall enough to make her persona non grata with her own family. The way August 22nd, 1961 started gave Mauricia no hint of what was to come or chance to wonder if she's the only one who had or was going to have a whole population under her control. And as fate would have it, her tainted wine will have qualities she'll cherish, so those she'll like less, some that'll be of little use to her, and a few that may harm her. And that was the Sochitilia bottles. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.